The next case, Ms. Stewart, you're on again. This time it's case number 71444, Robert Guarino v. State. Ms. Tonin for the prosecutors, Ms. Stewart for the appellant. You want to save a few minutes for rebuttal on this case?
Yes.
We've got 15?
Yes, please.
About two or three?
Yes,
that would
be fine.
I'll keep an eye on
this one. This one has an 82 count. Okay, this case also involves a robbery of a fast food store and once again involves a conviction for kidnapping as well. The victim, Cuevas, said that she thought her assailant was a fellow employee, but she had only seen him a few times before. The police showed her the driver's license of a person that used to work at Fast Bucks, and she said, yes, that's the one. So there wasn't actually even a photo lineup.
But didn't they get the name for the ID from the witness?
Yes.
The witness say it's Robert Guarino?
Yes.
Is this Robert Guarino?
Yes, yes.
Do you need a photo lineup in that situation? Somebody says they know who the person is?
Well, the problem here is that there was a videotape of the Motel 6 where Mr. Guarino was staying. The police saw the videotape. They did not collect the videotape. And it's our position that was bad faith in not doing that, because had they collected the videotape, that may have shown exactly what time he was leaving the Motel 6 and could have proven that he was not the one who could have possibly been the robber of the Fast Bucks.
Well, may have and could have is his argument. What evidence did you produce or was produced on his behalf that it was in fact exculpatory, it was in fact at that time, or what he was in fact wearing?
Well, that can't be proven because the police did not preserve the video. They were the only ones who had the opportunity to preserve the video. And when the defense objected to that video coming in pre-trial, the state argued that they were going to bring the policeman in to testify who had seen the video, and he would be able to testify as to the timestamp on the video. That policeman was never brought in to testify. And the court set forth a test for determining when a defendant should receive relief where the state fails to gather evidence in a criminal proceeding. That was in State versus Daniels. And the test is whether or not the evidence could change the outcome of the trial, whether the failure to preserve the evidence was gross negligence, and if that's the case, then there's a presumption in favor of the defendant that the evidence would have helped the defendant. And if the failure was in bad faith, then the remedy is dismissal of the case.
Well, was there ever any evidence presented from the defense as to what time he was in fact coming back to the motel, what he was wearing, or anything?
He did not testify. In order to have presented that type of evidence, he would have had to take the stand and testify. So no, there was no evidence of that. The biggest issue here is Ferretta. 4 weeks before trial, Guarino asked to represent himself. He also requested a short trial continuance. The request was denied. The court denied the request because he had requested a continuance. This court in Lyons upheld a denial of a request for a defendant to represent themselves. However, in that case, the defendant made the Ferretta request the day of trial. So while this court did discuss the issue that the defendant would need a continuance, that was not the only basis for this court upholding that denial of the request. Guarino contends that he should have been allowed to represent himself, and there was evidence presented that his attorney had not completed discovery, had not interviewed witnesses, was out of the country the entire week before trial, and was not even due to return on the day that trial was scheduled to commence. So we feel that was a clear violation of his Sixth Amendment right to represent himself, and that as a result, he should receive a new trial.
Can you address something for me? The deadly weapon enhancement. enhancements. And the evidence supporting that conviction.
The deadly weapon enhancement, the victim said that she saw something white in the assailant's hand. She said that she didn't know if it was a knife. She admitted that it could have been a folding comb or a piece of plastic. In Smith versus State, unpublished decision, this court held that where no knife was actually seen by the victim and no knife was found when the defendant was arrested, there was insufficient evidence to sustain the deadly weapon enhancement.
Well, Smith was issued in 2014 before we allowed public or citation to unpublished opinions in 2016.
Okay. That's the only case that I have found that directly addresses that. But just on the facts and what the victim said.
Are you familiar with Bias versus State?
I don't have that in my notes. I'm sorry. As to the kidnap, are there more questions on that issue?
No, not for me, no. Thank you.
Okay, on the kidnapping issue, this is very similar to the situation in Garcia versus State where one of the victims was locked inside the establishment but was able to escape by a side door that was held to be not false imprisonment. In this case, the victim was locked inside, but there were windows in the back. The state argued and the victim testified that there were boxes in front of the windows, the windows couldn't be opened, et cetera, but the boxes could have been moved and the window could have been broken. In addition, she had a telephone. She actually called for help. The defendant or the perpetrator poured some liquid in front of the door. The liquid turned out to be harmless bleach, so it did not increase the risk of harm by confining her to that space. And we feel that the kidnapping charge should be reversed. As to the coercion charge, that arises pursuant to the information from ordering her to place the phone on the floor and by pouring liquid on the floor in front of the door. Coercion statute requires that there is use or threatened violence or injury, deprivation, depriving the person of any tool or hindering them in the use of a tool or attempting to intimidate a person by threat or force. The only section that would apply to her ordering her to put the phone on the floor is section B, depriving the person of any tool or hindering them in the use of the tool. She wasn't deprived of the use of the phone because she was able to pick it up and actually call for help. Pouring liquid on the floor, section A does not apply because pouring liquid on the floor did not threaten violence or injury. The liquid was merely bleach. B does not apply because the door was locked, so the bleach was not a deterrent to using the front door. She could have simply walked to the back.
Well, she didn't know that it was bleach.
Right, but the statute doesn't talk about knowledge. It talks about whether or not there was actually use or threatened violence or an attempt to intimidate the person.
Isn't that kind of intimidating? What if you're allergic to bleach?
Well, she didn't have to walk across the bleach. She could walk to the back of the store. She didn't need to get near the bleach. And like I said before, she was able to call for help. I don't have anything further unless the court has any more questions.
You can save your 6 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. Charles Thumble on behalf of respondent. I will address the arguments made by appellant in the order in which they were presented to the court. First, as to the fifth issue, the state did not improperly fail to preserve the surveillance videotape at the Motel 6. First off, this wasn't an identity case. As Justice Stiglitz alluded to, the victim actually identified the defendant by name, So prior to the detective ascertaining a driver's license photo of the defendant, saying, quite frankly, is this the Robert Garina that you're talking about that used to be an ex-employee at this very business? So identity wasn't an issue at that point. It was superfluous. I think what we have here is the appellant asserting a mere hoped-for conclusion as to what the surveillance video would have shown. And quite frankly, it's controverted by additional evidence that was presented, namely that the appellant returned to the Motel 6 the day of the robbery, but then left despite having paid for an additional night's stay, showing flight from the scene. Additionally, the appellant's ex-wife testified that the appellant was unemployed and texting her for money in the days and moments leading up to the robbery. However, after the robbery, appellant suddenly had money to purchase items such as new shoes, clothes, and a backpack, which he had on his person when he was ultimately arrested. We don't believe there's been a showing of bad faith here. We don't believe this evidence is exculpatory, and quite frankly, I believe this is a mere hoped-for conclusion. As to the Feretta issue raised by appellant, the district court didn't abuse its discretion in denying appellant's request to self-representation. The request was untimely and no reasonable cause was given per Lyons. This case had been pending over a year. The request by way of appellant's motion was heard 2 weeks prior to the trial. And I think the biggest distinguishing characteristic here between Feretta and the case at bar is that Feretta doesn't specify in advance how soon a Feretta motion should be made for self-representation. Feretta is distinguished from this case in that in Feretta, he had several weeks to prepare for trial. There was no delay, whereas here, appellant made affirmatively stated that he would need to continue this trial in order to be able to be prepared. Untimeliness was inherent here in the lack of ability to be prepared because of the short time frame in which appellant raised his request for self-representation and the trial setting date. Of note, the appellant had already had two prior continuances of the trial date requested by appellant. The appellant had also had a previous court-appointed attorney that was dismissed as counsel on his motion, his pro per motion. Appellant was requesting yet another continuance along with self-representation in the final hour leading up to trial. We have not enough time to prepare by his own admission, showing the inherent untimeliness of the request, and he provided no reasonable cause for why he didn't raise that earlier.
Let me ask this, but for the timeliness, that's the reason it was denied. In other words, because of the timeliness, it was denied, the Feretta motion was denied.
And for unnecessary delay, the fact that the appellant had been asking for prior continuances, prior counsel to be dismissed, now he wants another court-appointed attorney dismissed, untimeliness and undue delay by the court. Moving on to the third issue raised by...
Is that what the record, though, shows that it's because it's untimely and that it caused delay?
And I believe that's in our respondent brief. We had the actual exchange between the judge and defendant when he was raising the issue, and they said, we're not going to have you delay these proceedings any further based upon this request. With regard to the deadly weapon enhancement, I would note that trial counsel for appellant did engage in some skillful cross-examination of the victim, and that's what was referenced in appellant's brief. However, the victim in this case, in volume 3 of appellant's appendix, page 610, the victim testified that the appellant had a folding knife in his hand and that she was familiar with what a folding knife looked like. Further, appellant's appendix, volume 3, pages 611 through 612, the victim testified that she was scared the appellant was going to hurt her because he had a knife on him. The fact that the blade wasn't exposed or opened in this case is inconsequential. I would submit to you that it's analogous to a robber who displays a gun in his waistband to a potential victim for purposes or means of fear or injury, too. So the fact that the blade...
Are all knives deadly weapons?
I would submit to you that a knife is capable of death is deadly.
What if it's a 2-inch blade?
Doesn't mean it can't be used in a deadly manner.
Was there a 2-inch blade exposed?
Not in this case.
And she specifically testified that she couldn't tell the difference between an open screw or perhaps folding comb?
And again, this is a skillful cross-examination by Mr. Hughes, the trial counsel. However, the appellant testified that he was holding a folding knife, and she knows what one looks like. And in fact, that's why she was afraid, was because he had a knife on him.
What other testimony was there to describe the type of knife that it was and its characteristics?
The testimony of the victim, as referenced in my previous argument, Appellate's Appendix, Volume 3, pages 610 through 612.
Specifically, that he was carrying a folding knife, that's it.
That he was carrying a folding knife, that the victim was familiar with what a folding knife looked like. She had prior knowledge, and that's why she knew what it was. And that's why she was afraid, because he had a knife on him. Moving on to the appellate's argument attacking the kidnapping conviction. I think the facts are important here, and they are borne out in the record. Appellate approached the victim outside of the store. She was opening the store for business that morning. He approached her from outside the store and forced her in. This movement was in excess of what was necessary to commit the robbery, because he could have simply grabbed the keys from her, gone inside the store himself, and perpetrated the robbery. There was evidence that he was a prior employee of the Fast Bucks business. This shows that a reasonable inference could be drawn that he had prior knowledge of where money was kept. Also, moving the victim inside the store removed her from the public view. There was testimony that there was a McDonald's just across the street. By removing her from the public view, it created a greater sense of danger, or increased risk of danger, and prevented her escape. The windows in the back of the business that have been talked about, these windows were incapable of being opened. You would have had to smash them out. Additionally, there were boxes in the back. It was essentially a storage area of the business that obstructed her ability to get to those windows. These are the factors per the Mendoza case that allow for convictions for both robbery and kidnapping.
And the jury was thoroughly instructed on the Mendoza, what Mendoza says about kidnapping and robbery.
I believe the state, we referenced that in our answering brief, what instruction was given with regard to kidnapping. With regard to the coercion challenge by appellant, the defendant ordered the victim to disconnect the phone and throw it on the ground. This was a landline. It prevented the victim from being able to call for help, which she had a right to do. At that point, appellant had already robbed her of her cell phone and wallet. So this was a further attempt to prevent her from seeking help. She testified she was in a state of fear and shock at that point, visibly shaken by the testimony of the officer who arrived at scene. The unknown liquid that the appellant poured on the floor in front of the door, this is highly intimidating. This victim has no idea what this is. It could be acid, it could be some noxious substance, and ultimately it prevented her from escaping.
Counsel indicated she could have gone out the back door.
The only other exit was the back windows, not back door.
Okay. I didn't understand that.
And further, appellant actually locked her into the store, and the responding officer had to pick the lock in order to get the door open. So this was highly intimidating, and it was reasonable for the victim to fear what this unknown liquid was that had been poured by the appellant on the floor directly in front of her means of escape, which ultimately she wouldn't have been able to do with the locking of the door. I would note further, as borne out by the trial testimony of the victim and the officer, the appellant had an acute knowledge of this business, not only by being a former employee, but by the fact that when he entered the business, he stayed close to the door when he was ordering her around. He actually sprayed a substance on the surveillance video camera to prevent, a further recording of this robbery that he perpetrated. And ultimately, we believe that the defendant's acute knowledge of the layout of this store also enhanced his intimidation of the witness as to the coercion charge, and knowing that that's her only means of escape would be that front door, pouring the liquid and locking it. There are no further questions. I'll submit the matter.
Thank you, members.
Thank you.
Mr. Trump, thank you. Ms. Stewart, you have about 6 minutes.
Karina submits that this is not an identity case. It is an identity case. He pled not guilty. Also, as the state pointed out, if he was an employee and he knew the layout of the store, then he could have simply gone in and gotten the money. The fact that he did not just take the keys and go in and get the money suggests that he didn't know where the money was and that he needed the victim in this case to go and get the money for him. Additionally, if he was an employee, then he would have known that there was a second phone in the back of the store, and so throwing the phone in the front of the store on the floor would not have had any significance. So those two things suggest that he was not an employee and that the video from the Motel 6 may have been dispositive in this case. The state also argued that the Ferretta request was untimely and that the hearing on that was held only 2 weeks before trial. That's true. However, the request to represent himself was made 4 weeks before trial.
I can understand Ferretta, you know, it should be granted in most cases, but there's a time in this thing about undue delay. And he says, I need more time. That shoots the Ferretta issue, to tell you the truth. It just doesn't fly that if you want to represent yourself, you've got to abide by the schedule that's set by the judge.
Correct, Your Honor. But this man was caught in a situation where his attorney wasn't doing anything for him. His attorney was even out of the country the week before the trial. His office could not even get in touch with the attorney by telephone. They could only text him.
What was wrong with the previous attorney?
I don't remember that part of it. I don't remember him getting rid of his previous attorney. I don't remember the circumstances of why that attorney was not representing him.
Your client had that attorney for 7 months before the trial date and didn't raise that issue. Told the judge he didn't really have a problem with his attorney and thought he was a good attorney. So while there were some...
Are you talking about the trial attorney?
I'm talking about the trial attorney.
Okay.
So while there may have been, you know, some dispute about what you're bringing up about whether he followed some strategic choices that the counsel was making, whether he agreed or he wanted to take those over.
I think as it got closer and closer to trial and he realized that his attorney had not interviewed witnesses that he had suggested, he had not conducted discovery, he had not come to see him, I think that he wanted it to work with his attorney, but as it got closer and closer to trial, he just realized that his attorney wasn't doing anything for him, his attorney was going to be out of town, and he just felt that he was not getting any representation at all. And Ferretta says that a request to self-represent is valid if it's made weeks before trial. I realize that in Ferretta it was made many more weeks before trial than in this case, but several cases have held that Ferretta request made weeks before trial is should be granted.
Well, it's timeliness. It's the timeliness. The undue delay, rather. It's not the timeliness. It's undue delay. Of the day of trial, he wants to represent himself. You know, sometimes the judge has to let the person represent himself, as long as he's willing to abide by the schedule. So it's really not the timeliness in this case, it's the undue delay. And I think that's what I pressed Mr. Toman on, that it was undue delay, not just the timeliness.
Okay, just on that same point, I didn't see in the record you're asserting now that counsel was going to be unavailable, was traveling, or wasn't going to be there on the day of trial. That's not what I see, at least in the transcript that was appended to the record on that.
That was addressed in the opening brief, and it was referenced back to the appendix.
But not argued to the judge.
I don't have that in front of me, so I don't. Let me see. I have it here in my brief.
That's right. I don't want to use your time. You have a little bit left.
Okay. I mean, these are the things that were in the record, that his attorney had not completed discovery, he had not interviewed witnesses, he was out of the country the entire week before trial. So I'm not sure that his attorney would have argued that to the judge, but certainly Mr. Garina pointed those things out to the judge, either in his motion or orally, Otherwise, it wouldn't have been in the record. I wouldn't have known anything about it because I was not the trial attorney.
Well, I think he would have been better off challenging the attorney rather than trying to represent himself. In other words, I think the Young case is one where the judge would have to take certain actions to resolve the conflict between the attorney and the client. But to just move for Retta was not, and then to say, I want to represent myself, but I'm not ready to go, that's a killer in this issue.
Well, I think that the judge could have said to him, I'll let you represent yourself, but you're not going to get a continuance, and leave it up to the defendant whether or not he wanted to proceed that way or whether he wanted to stay with that attorney.
Didn't she do that?
I don't believe that she did.
He said he'd need more time.
I mean, he was a lay person. He didn't know what else to do. He's saying, I want to represent myself. He made this request 4 weeks before trial.
But the attorney was standing there when he made this request and didn't say anything, didn't do anything?
I'm not sure that the attorney was there.
How could the attorney not appear? I mean, until he's relieved.
I'm not sure that his trial attorney was there. It might have been.
He was there. Ed Hughes was there.
Was he there?
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, okay. Your time is up. Thank you very much to Mr. Stoneman and Ms. Stewart. Thank you for your arguments and briefs in this matter.